Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
This is World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty coming up in the programme. As always, there's an important ruling for those FTX customers.
98% of creditors, people who are owed money, will receive 118% of what they were owed back.
But not all customers are happy. We're going to find out why. And there is an important ruling for one of the world's biggest tech companies, Alphabet, which of course owns Google. There were lots of stories that have developed over the course of the last couple of hours, so we could have began the programme with any of them, to be honest with you. But we decided to go with this story because we talk so much, don't we, about the impact that the weather is having on different economies. And in the United States at the moment, thousands of people are shutting their houses and offices and evacuating as they prepare for yet another hurricane. Hurricane Milton has rapidly intensified into Category 5 storm as it tears its way towards the US Gulf Coast. Here's our correspondent in Mexico, Will Grant, with more details.
It is a very big storm. At Category 5, it's bringing somewhere in the region of 250 kilometres an hour winds. It's somewhere around 1,000, 1,100 kilometres southwest of Tampa at the moment, but it is steadily making its way towards the Florida coastline. It may clip the Yucatan Peninsula too en route, and certainly Mexico and Cuba are likely to get lashed with rain and high winds as a result. But really, the brunt of this is expected to be in Florida. And of course, Floridians know hurricanes. They're experienced with hurricane season. But nevertheless, such is the size of what is actually the 10th major hurricane this season. It is a daunting prospect.
Let's pick up on some of the points that Will raised there, because this hurricane could prompt Florida's largest evacuation in 7 years. Speaking at a news conference in Tampa, the emergency management director for Hillsborough County, Timothy Dudley Jr., urged residents at risk to leave whilst they still can.
It's time to start implementing your evacuation plans, preparing your family, your pets, your property, and your businesses. Do it right now while the weather's still clear and you still have time. When it's time, before those impacts come, you need to be out of the evacuation zone. This storm is a serious storm. You do not have to leave the county. We have enough shelters for you.
We wanted to hear from a business in the area. How do you cope when you're facing such a hurricane, particularly as you've already just been through one? So I've been speaking to Justin Bellett, Chief Operations Officer for Truly Nolan Pest Control of America. They have, as you're about to hear, lots of employees across the state.
And every storm is a little bit different, and the potential impact from the storm is different each and every time. So it's very stressful to be thinking about the moving target of anticipating how is it going to impact your business. Typically, I don't park our vehicles centrally. I let people take them as long as they're in a safe place. But like in this case, I have 200 vehicles on the west coast of Florida I just pulled off the road because anticipating flooding.
This storm seems to be getting stronger and stronger. What are you doing at the moment to try and protect your business, protect your employees?
First and foremost is you have to have flexibility. In the state of Florida, we have close to 500 employees. I expect potential impact from this storm to at least half of those employees. They have their homes to think about, their families to think about, the evacuation zone, what happens when they shut down all the schools, which they have in the last 24 hours. So you have to be ultra accommodating to your employees first and foremost. Then you have to start to think about company assets. For us, it's our vehicles, our buildings. Then, you know, it really gets into thinking about your team members throughout the storm. Keep in constant communication with them to make sure they're okay. You know, what are you going to do once the storm passes to support them? My goal is to get people back to work as quick as I can, because in the moment, they're not thinking about what's going on with their income. They're only thinking about what's happening with their current situation. And I'm thinking about, like, how am I going to keep their income flowing? You know, because 2 weeks from now, when that paycheck comes in and they see that it's so small, they're going to, it's going to add to their stress level.
It is, isn't it? It is. And one other thing that we hear a lot about, particularly when it comes to Florida, is problems with insurance, particularly when it comes to home insurance. I'm sure that's a problem for businesses. You mentioned vehicles. Does that all get more difficult?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like after the storm from 2 weeks ago and this one, I don't know what's going to happen with the insurance market here. You know, it's already costs are going through the roof. You're going to see most insurance companies pull out of the state of Florida after the storm.
Are you fully covered?
Yes, I am. Like this year, I've had to switch insurance companies three different times because one was pulling out, another one wanted to double my costs. And you're in a constant negotiation with insurance companies trying to insure your home, because a lot of times your mortgage requires you to have homeowners insurance. Yeah. So I can only imagine what's to come after this storm. It's going to be bad.
You rightly said the first priority is to protect lives. And we saw what happened with the last hurricane, how devastating that was. But on that economic aspect, how difficult is it now to do business in Florida?
On an economic aspect, you know, I don't view it as being any more difficult than, you know, historical times. You know, I feel like these things happen in kind of like these runs. We got hit many years ago by Hurricane Andrew and other hurricanes. The rising cost, just general inflation, is no different here than anywhere else.
But the insurance situation is difficult for people.
Yes. The insurance situation is definitely difficult, but it hasn't slowed down population growth.
Slowing down business growth, economic growth? It must be having some impact there.
Oh, yeah. I think it's definitely having impacts on people, how much they can afford to do. I absolutely do. Like, you know, one, for instance, we don't own as many company buildings as we used to historically. We sold off some and rented because of the liability. That's a shift in the market for us. You know, it's easier for me to rent and not worry about what happens when a storm hits than to have a $2 million building that gets destroyed. There's definitely shifts in business that absolutely are happening.
Justin there, and we're going to keep in touch with him over the course of the next few days. Let's bring in Peter Jankowskis, Arbor Financial Services, regular voice on the program. It was a pleasure having you with us on World Business Report, Peter. And we've seen the impact of what that weather on the stock market today in the US, because we've seen shares of insurance stocks like Chubb, Progressive, and Kinsale Capital. They've fallen, haven't they?
Yes, they have, anywhere from 3.5% to 4.5%. So people are expecting there to be some significant underwriting losses. I've also seen some stories, though, that many of these insurance companies have been very active in trying to protect themselves by changing the terms of their policies as well. So it may turn out that the negative impact on the insurance companies is not as large as people are anticipating.
Yeah, we will, of course, keep across that story here on the BBC World Service. Let us return to a company that we've spoken a lot about over the last couple of years, FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried. I'm sure that rings a bell for many of you, the fallen crypto exchange. Well, now a U.S. judge has authorized a plan to return money to former customers. How is that plan going to work? Connor Sefton is a crypto journalist and podcaster. He's been telling me about the significance of this ruling.
So the judge has approved a plan to start compensating FTX customers. It means that they should receive collectively between $14.7 billion and $16.5 billion. And according to FTX, 98% of creditors, people who are owed money, will receive 118% of what they were owed back.
But I have spoken to some of those creditors, and they're not happy with this, are they? Because at the time when FTX ran into problems, things like Bitcoin were at very low prices. Now they're much higher. So they feel like they've lost out.
They have. And that's because the value of what they're going to receive is based on what the crypto markets were worth in November 2022, which is when FTX went into bankruptcy. So it's bad news if you had a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, which was worth $17,000 at the time of the bankruptcy and is almost four times higher today at about $63,000. So the compensation is going to be based on what Bitcoin was worth 2 years ago.
Is that a pretty standard practice?
Well, yes and no. There have been some crypto bankruptcies where people are receiving compensation in digital assets. The issue is that FTX had far less crypto than customers were led to believe, which means actually it isn't actually possible for people to receive the crypto that they had or thought they had in their accounts back.
And Judge John Dorsey has given his final approval, hasn't he, to this reorganization plan. So is that it? I mean, is this the end of it now? Those who are not happy, have they got anywhere else to go?
There is a slim chance of an appeal. That's unlikely because creditors actually had to vote on this plan back in August and 95% approved of that plan. It is a bit of the end of a saga for FTX, but there is still going to be a delay in terms of repayments because people who are owed less than $50,000 will probably only start to see money at the end of this year. Anyone owed more than that could be waiting well into 2025 for compensation.
And just reminders, we're talking about a pretty substantial sum of money in total here, aren't we?
Yes, a very substantial amount of money, up to $16.5 billion being repaid. And it's always worth reflecting on the fact that FTX collapsed because they were misusing customer funds, using a sister trading firm to make risky bets. And that led to a substantial jail term for its founder, Sam Bankman-Fried.
Peter, we heard from Connor there about the scale of the money involved. I mean, this was one of the biggest fraud cases of recent times, wasn't it? Sam Bankman-Fried got 25 years for defrauding customers. But since then, as we heard, Bitcoin has been on a bit of a charge.
Indeed. And that's the whole reason that investors are really getting anything back out of this. They're very fortunate to have been in an investment that has appreciated so greatly. It's kind of ironic to me, people complaining about getting more than 100% out of a bankruptcy situation.
Yeah, I suppose so. But, you know, that is worth a lot more than it was. In terms of, you know, you're there in the markets and crypto, as we've seen in this, though this was a case of fraud, it is still, many people think, highly speculative. But are we seeing it become a little bit more part of the financial establishment?
It certainly is becoming more so with the SEC moving and allowing crypto-based ETFs in the marketplace. However, despite all of that, it remains incredibly speculative. I think it also kind of gives you a sense of the amount of liquidity overall that continues to flow through the markets, even as the Fed is starting to lower rates. That's really what supports speculative assets like crypto.
The SEC, US Securities and Exchange Commission, and those ETFs, they're sort of tracker funds. We often see them linked to equities and particular sectors of the stock exchange. Right, we're going to stay in the world of tech now because there's been another important case because Google, which of course is owned by Alphabet, has been ordered to open its Play Store to rivals. Why is that so important? Let's bring in our tech correspondent. Somebody can answer all these questions. Lily Jamali joins us once again. Lily, and a lot of people won't understand why this is so important, where this case has come from, but it is. Explain why.
Yeah, well, it's part of the sort of a deluge of cases that Google has been facing on the antitrust and monopoly front. And we can talk about some of the other ones if you'd like. But this particular case, in a nutshell, means that Google has to open up its Google Play App Store to rivals for 3 years. It will have to distribute app stores belonging to other parties through its own app store. It will no longer be able are allowed to pay companies to launch apps exclusively or first on Google Play. And this all stems from a lawsuit that Epic Games, the maker of the popular game Fortnite, stems from a lawsuit that Epic brought against Google a couple of years ago. It sued Google and Apple, by the way, saying that Google had stifled competition in the app marketplace. It won this jury verdict in December. And now here we are seeing what the remedies are going to look like. Basically, this is about giving consumers and app developers as well more options.
And as you said, that we have a series of antitrust cases, don't we, against some of these big tech companies. So how significant in that whole scheme of things is this ruling?
I think it's significant. I mean, it feels like there's a wave of movement on the antitrust front here. Google just got another unfavorable ruling in a major case involving really its bread and butter, which is online search. A judge in Washington, D.C. ruling that Google does indeed operate a monopoly in that space. And we recently moved into the next phase of that case, in which the judge there is going to start working on suggesting remedies. That'll take a couple months. And then there's a separate antitrust case involving Google's alleged monopoly in advertising technology. Arguments just wrapped up there last month. We're expecting a ruling by the end of the year. Both of those cases were brought by the U.S. government. This one is, you know, another corporate entity, Epic Games, saying that Google has not been playing fair. So it's a little bit different in that regard.
I use the phrase, you use the phrase, but a lot of people won't know what it means. Briefly, if you don't mind, antitrust, just explain that.
Yeah, it's basically this notion that a company is not playing on a equal or level playing field, that they're taking steps to block out competition. And, you know, Google is, again, fighting against those allegations on multiple fronts now. But in this case, they say, look, we do compete. And the company that they're floating as proof, actually, is a very familiar name. It's Apple. They're saying that Apple and Google's Android clearly compete against each other. They're competing directly for consumers, and that Android is not a market unto itself. So I think it's interesting that they're sort of pulling in another tech giant in order to make their case.
Yeah, Lily, always a pleasure speaking to you. Thanks so much for joining us. Peter, briefly, if you don't mind, I mean, we are seeing regulators, aren't they, really looking closely at these tech companies, which are the world's biggest tech companies at the moment, but doesn't really seem to affect their valuations.
Well, I think you're starting to see some pressure. Google was down 2.75% today, I believe. Some of that certainly is due to this news. But also, in fact, they are facing, ironically, increasing competition, because there are also stories out talking about how Google's share of the search-based ad market has actually been declining over the last few years. So in some ways, the regulators are maybe even a little late to the party. But the combined impact of the regulatory push, the lawsuits, all of that is putting more pressure on these stocks.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
service. We've been talking a lot about the world's largest economy. Let's talk about the world's second largest economy now. Because in a few hours' time, the stock markets in China will reopen after the Golden Week holiday. They had been surging before the break. Whilst they've been shut, the Hang Seng, the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, has now hit a 32-month high, leading to headlines like this one.
So recently, there's been some news in the Hong Kong market. Do you want to find out why is it that there's such a strong rally recently in the Hong Kong market? What's happening over there?
And after those stock markets open in China, senior officials from the country's top planning agency will brief reporters on their plans to stimulate the economy. That is an important moment. Let's bring in Professor Anne Lee, author of Will China's Economy Collapse? So who better to have a look at what may happen when the markets open and what we may get from that planning agency? The markets themselves, Professor, do you expect them to surge?
I think right now there is a lot of optimism about the stimulus package and what they might announce further. And so I do expect it to continue surging, especially since they've already telegraphed in the past that they are not done with the stimulus. They're going to continue to roll out more in the future to keep the economy humming. So I think that a lot of investors, you know, assume there'll be, you know, more measures, and therefore this rally could go on for a little while longer.
Go ahead. But we both had at the same time. The rally may go on, but the fundamental problems facing the Chinese economy, will the measures that have been announced so far be enough to tackle that? And are we going to see further measures coming, do you think?
So a lot of people are waiting to see if they're going to announce more fiscal measures, because a lot of the previous measures were largely monetary related, you know, by lowering mortgage rates, interest rates, lowering reserve ratios. And so people are wondering, will there be more direct investments into the economy?
What do you think, though? Because, you know, when you say monetary, you know, fiscal policy is the government, and the Chinese government, many people are saying, needs to start spending a lot more on infrastructure, even putting money in bank accounts of people. Are we going to see that? You know, when the planning agency speaks, could we see a move down that line? Because that would be hugely significant, wouldn't it?
I mean, they may for the poor and low-income groups, but I would say that subsidies of that nature, like providing subsidies for them to buy appliances, they're more one-time, one-off situations, and that's not going to make it sustainable. What would make it more sustainable is if they announced, you know, even more support for their long-term investments in the tech sector. We have to remember that the market was floundering because they missed the whole surge in AI, given that the U.S. government had put in sanctions and export controls so that Chinese semiconductor companies, you know, couldn't import semiconductor equipment to make AI-related products. And so they were caught, you know, flat-footed and behind the U.S. in that sense, and Taiwan. And so what would really boost confidence would be if they actually announced specific measures to boost, say, the tech sectors and other special areas that would help them become more self-reliant that they say they want to be in science and technology and in terms of domestic demand. You know, those are going to be more challenging because you can't just throw money at, you know, making people, you know, suddenly more innovative. I mean, these things take a long time to develop. So they may support more, but that would not be an instant fix. And truly the big elephant in the room is whether there's going to be more stability in the geopolitical space between U.S. and China, between Europe and China.
Well, that is a big question, isn't it, Professor? Thank you so much for joining us on the program. That press conference will start in about 4 hours' time, going to be an important one. Peter, briefly, if you don't mind, we talk a lot about the world's biggest economy here. But even in the U.S., people will be focusing on China because it's such a key part of the global economy.
Indeed. You know, they're a major user of commodities and a major supplier of commodities to the rest of the world, finished goods. You know, here in the U.S., we're primarily a service economy, and that's fueled by the ability to bring in imports and sell them. So they are a critical cog in the overall economy.
Now, it is less than a month until Election Day in the US. Both the Harris and Trump campaigns have been presenting their economic visions to the American people, lots of different policies in there. But how are they going to be paid for? A new report from the Nonpartisan Nonprofit Committee for Responsible Federal Budget finds that both different campaigns and the policies they have will deepen the national debt. The president of that committee is Maya McGuinness, and she joins us now. Maya, thanks for wading through all those different policies and costing them for us. I'm sure that's not an easy job. What did you find? I mean, is there one campaign that's going to not put the country into as much debt as the other?
Well, the unfortunate outcome is that what we found is that both campaigns are filled with promises that overall would absolutely fail to fix the huge fiscal problems that we have, would in all likelihood increase the level of borrowing with quite a range from not increasing it at all for Harris at the low end to up to $8 trillion over 10 years. And what we found is that former President Trump's effect would probably be roughly twice that size, from a range of about $1.5 trillion to a whopping $15 trillion over 10 years.
Why is that? Is that because of tax cuts?
Yes, well, both campaigns have lots of tax cuts and lots of spending increases and fewer offsets to overall offset those costs of those. But in both cases, the Harris campaign has tax cuts that aren't quite as large and does more to offset those. They've also made a commitment that they wouldn't add to the debt. We don't find that their policies quite lay out the details of how to achieve that yet. But starting with that promise is a good point. The Trump campaign has talked less about meeting any fiscal metric, and they have much larger tax cuts. And in many cases, because we have a range of things, much higher spending as well on the areas of defense and changes to immigration. So I think the bottom line is, we can't afford to be adding anything to the debt, and both of these plans would be on track to add trillions. So there's a real problem no matter where you look.
Well, that doesn't sound very good moving forward for the U.S. economy. I mean, it is such a huge problem, the U.S. net debt, and we keep getting these situations when we're on the verge of a shutdown. I suppose they keep making these promises because they think it gets them votes.
Well, both those points about the shutdown and the huge debt are exactly right. So we have huge levels of polarization, the way that both political parties think they win over voters, and they're probably right, is to promise them tax cuts and spending increases. And so that's why we get political promises. They're rewarded, and we have kind of a competition to see who can give away more things. But the problem is our Congress and our political leaders don't make any changes until they're absolutely forced to. That's why we're always on the verge of a shutdown, and sometimes even something as serious as a default, because we don't find our choices really willing to, our political leaders willing to engage in those hard choices, the trade-offs of budgeting. We don't even pass budgets very often right now. And while fiscal responsibility is critical for the strength of the economy, the sustainability of the economy, there is no short-term action-forcing moment to require it. And so we keep making things worse.
I wonder, the politicians clearly have to take some responsibility here, but so do the voters as well, because, they are given things that they want, but they can't really afford. Isn't it time that they maybe had a different voice?
Yeah, it's a great question, because it's kind of a circular reinforcing problem. So you have politicians who promise all these goodies and giveaways, and I think the voters start to think, well, I guess if everybody says we can have them, we can, and they deep down know it's not true, but who doesn't want to take, the dessert instead of the spinach if that's what you're offered? And what we've seen in the past is the only way this issue becomes a central issue on the political agenda is from the top. Yep. It's the top down. It has to be leadership. But we haven't had this bad a fiscal situation and this level of polarization at any point before. And so it's hard to see how we get out of this mess. That's what we try to do by putting a report like this out, so that it will wake up people to the importance of paying attention to it.
Maya, it was fascinating talking to you. I'm a dessert rather than a spinach person, I have to be perfectly honest with you. But great having you on the program. Thanks to Peter as well. We'll end with a bit of pop news. Taylor Swift has passed Rihanna to become the world's richest female musician, according to Forbes magazine. That is it for this edition of World Business Report.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
Most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.